this. I volunteered to go to the hospital first and find out what the family needs. If we all went together, I said, we'd overwhelm them. Instead, I'd do reconnaissance and return with a full report. They agreed that was the best way. Now I just need to make sure I keep Katrina isolated. The PICU is one large room segmented by curtains, and Sadie's in quarantine. That means that yellow and black hazard tape has been laid down on the floor around her curtained area, and everyone who comes into Sadie's sphere has to wear latex gloves and a gown over their clothes. There are face masks, too, but when I draw back the curtain, I see that Katrina and Doug aren't wearing theirs. See? What kind of parents are those? I've never trusted Doug. For one thing, he married her. Also, there's just something sketchy about him. You can tell he's used to being liked all the time. He needs it like air, and I never trust those people. He can tell I don't buy his act, and that makes him nervous. Good. Hi, I whisper through my mask. The neighbors sent me to check on you guys. Hey, Doug says too loud. Thank you for coming. Like he's throwing a party. We're already assuming the weekend barbecue is canceled. Down, dog. Down, Doug. His only concern should be Sadie, not pleasing me. He doesn't have to be a good host by his daughter's ICU bed. But Sadie, that poor kid. She's in what looks like a small plexiglass box, raised on a platform, wearing a baby-size hospital gown. A tangle of wires, lines, and tubes runs from her to the hissing, beeping machines. A light is taped to her finger, and plastic tips are inserted in each tiny nostril to deliver oxygen. There are round, flesh-colored patches affixed to her chest and upper leg, and stents in her hands that are attached to boards. I assume it's so she won't remove the IVs, similar to how dogs wear cones around their necks so they won't pull out stitches. She's just so restricted. She's also eerily quiet, motionless. Her skin has a decidedly yellow cast to it. Katrina follows my eyes. She must like what she sees in them, and she must trust my tears, which are genuine. I never wanted this to happen. Sadie's so innocent. I want to think she's dreaming of being somewhere else, sucking from some giant boob in the sky. The nurses say it's good for her to sleep, Katrina says softly. Her body's working so hard to fight the infection. Her voice is hoarse. I can tell she's been crying a lot. Doug's hair is disheveled, but other than that, you wouldn't be able to guess he has a sick baby. I'm sure she's a fighter, I say. Katrina gives me a sharp look while Doug smiles, like he appreciates my intent. As if he has any idea of my intent. Katrina starts to speak in this weird, spacey voice. Sometimes I think about who has a better prognosis, the screamer or the sleeper. Do you hear her? I shake my head. There's this little baby even younger than Sadie who's been crying the whole time we've been here. She's not crying now, I say. Oh, she's not? Katrina looks confused. She's cracking up so easily. I thought that's what I wanted, but it's hard to see anyone go through this. I'm hoping both babies will be okay, she says. But I worry there's a quota, like a certain number of people in here have to die to make room for others. I look to Doug. It seems like he isn't even listening to her. There's no outward acknowledgement of how peculiar she sounds. Maybe he's heard it before, and he's just tuning her out at this point. I can't exactly tell what's transpiring between them. Like there's a quota from God, a big cosmic ledger. I don't want Sadie to be pitted against the others like that. I don't want to compete with the other parents to see who can pray the hardest.
You can't compete with other parents, Katrina. With what you've done, the win. In a great big gladiatorial arena, with God pointing his scepter to decide who lives and who dies, Sadie's a goner.
But I hope not. She's just a little baby. She doesn't deserve to pay for the sins of her mother. The problem is, it doesn't work that way. The innocent feel the pain, and evil walks free all the time. There are only two chairs. One is hard-backed, and the other is the upholstered type that converts into a bed, albeit a pretty uncomfortable one. Doug jumps from the hard-backed chair, realizing that he's forgotten his manners, but there's something phony in his gentlemanly gesture.
"Why don't you sit down?" he says to me. "Stay a while, since you came all the way down."
"It's not far."
"Well, it was really nice of you anyway."
"I'm supposed to report back," I say. "Tell the others what you need, so we can organize." "How long is she going to be here? Do you know?"
Katrina shakes her head sorrowfully.
"Could we start bringing some meals?" I offer.
"We don't need anything."
Her voice has gone cold.
It's unnerving how she flits between spacey and penetrating. I'm not sure if it's that she doesn't trust me, specifically, or that she doesn't trust an emissary of the AV. I can understand that. The notes have gotten a little more menacing. At this point, I have to speed things up. I can't take this much longer. That's why I had to come here.
"Some food would be nice," Doug says.
Katrina turns to glare at him.
"Well, you need to eat and I need to eat."
Doug's tone is defensive. Something's going on between them, clearly. They haven't really looked at each other the whole time I've been here.
"I don't want anyone coming here."
Her tone is absolute.
"Cat,"
Doug begins.
"I said no."
Now they're looking at each other all right. I'm curious to see which one of them will back down, and when it's Doug, I have the strangest reaction. I actually think, "Good girl, Katrina," like I'm rooting for her. How insane is that?
"Just think about it," I say.
"After I leave, you can text me. I'll make myself available every day."
"That's really kind of you," Doug says.
Katrina says nothing. She's looking at Sadie, her eyes brimming with tears.
"I'll leave you two alone."
Doug is on the balls of his feet, all nervous energy.
"I need a walk, anyway."
Turning his head, but not his eyes, in Katrina's direction, he says,
"Remember, my parents will be here soon."
There's a strange warning in it. Then he slips out.
"You said you don't want anyone here," I say.
"I totally respect that. Should I clear out?" I need to get her permission. That's critical. She needs to think my presence is, on some level, her idea. It's kind of handy wearing the mask and gown. I won't have to do that much acting. Plus, it makes it much less likely that she'll finally recognize me.
"Do you want me to go?"
I ask again.
Chapter 23. Cat. I can't believe I'm hesitating. She really should go. I can't trust her. I can't trust any of them. But I can see that she's really hurting for Sadie. And I'm just so fucking alone here. Crisis supposedly brings some couples together. That's not how it is for Doug and me. We're sitting together behind the hospital curtain with no privacy, so I can't ask him why he's acting this way. So distant. If I didn't know better, I'd think he blames me for Sadie's illness. I blame myself. I should have gotten her to a doctor sooner. I should have known she was sick. More time could have made a difference. They don't even know what the infection is. They're still waiting for more cultures to come back, and while it could ostensibly be good news that the ones so far have been negative, it means we're currently in the unknown. She's had vomiting and diarrhea, symptoms of jaundice and anemia, but they can't treat the source. They can just make her more comfortable and give her fluids. The rule is that only one parent can sleep by her side, and since I'm pumping milk, I'm the obvious choice. Doug slept in the waiting room last night. I was left alone here with Sadie and the industrial-strength pump that takes half the time. I couldn't even hear it over all the other hospital machines. I cried the whole time. She's not drinking it. The bottles are going in the floor refrigerator while fluids enter her little body intravenously. I haven't mustered an answer yet when a new doctor comes by. He's short, wiry, and hairy. He could be my savior, Sadie's savior, so I pump his hand and tell him just how happy I am to see him. "My husband's just stepped out," I say. "I can get him back really quickly. Can you wait? Or can you come back?"
"This will only take a minute," he responds.
It's true. His physical exam is incredibly brief, and Sadie sleeps right through it. I can hardly watch. It's like she's unconscious, like she's dead. Please, please let us be on the right side of the ledger. The doctor smiles and says,
"She's looking better."
I don't see what he sees, though I wish I could. He tells me that her last blood pressure reading was normal and her fever is well controlled.
All good signs.
He looks like he wants to wrap this up quickly, like he wishes he were doing wind sprints rather than practicing medicine. That's when I remember that she's still here, that I didn't tell her to leave. She's hearing everything. I don't want her knowing my business, reporting it back to anyone. But how can I kick her out now, in front of the doctor? He'd think I'm nuts. "What about the jaundice?" I say.
"That's about the same."
"And the anemia?"
"The anemia is mild. It might have been present before the illness and went undetected."
"So you're not treating her for it?"
"Not at present, no."
He looks like he really wants to bolt. I was just supposed to take his all good signs at face value and let him get on with his day.
"We're monitoring her symptoms very closely. We don't want to overtreat."
"Or undertreat?" She pipes up, and I can't help it. I look at her gratefully. It's like she's on my team, more than Doug has seemed. He's too busy sucking up to the doctors to pin them down on specifics. He just trusts way too easily. "But what's wrong?" I ask. "Do you know if it's viral or bacterial yet?"
"Not just yet. Some of the cultures will be ready tomorrow. She's already getting fluids and antibiotics. We're controlling her fever. Believe me, she's getting the best care."
He pats my arm.
"We've got this, Mom. Don't you worry."
As he leaves, I feel deflated. I fall into the chair, and again, I can't help it. I'm glad she's here. I'm just glad not to be alone. "That was good news, right?" she says, "about her blood pressure and temperature." No one was in here for more than an hour. No nurse and no doctor. I think that means she's doing better, but maybe it means they're giving up on her. I don't think it works that way. I don't know why, but I'm talking. I'm telling her the theory I just came up with, just since being here, about the circles of luck, which are also the circles of hell. In the outer circle, I tell her, there are all the people with healthy children. Their kids get common colds, but they never need to visit the ER. That's most people. That was me until now. And then, one circle in, it's Doug, Sadie, and me. The ones who are lucky because they have health insurance and access to good medical care. And when they realize something's wrong, they can bring her to a place like this. It could be worse. I know that. She's listening attentively. She's just so present. I've been missing that with Doug for a while, I realize. And this might sound crazy, but when I look into her eyes, I get this feeling like I've known her forever. I really must be losing it. But I keep talking, because I need to. There's a boy next to us, I continue. He whines sometimes, and the nurses go in and out constantly. His mom seems to know them really well. I overheard them talking about him. He's 3, and he's got some kind of brain tumor. This is his 5th surgery. The curtain was open one time, and I could see inside. His head is in this weird vise, like in the Hannibal Lecter movie. And I think, that's a circle worse than mine. Because Sadie will probably be fine, but he and his parents have to keep going through this time and time again. Or maybe he'll be cured. Maybe the 5th time is the charm. Or maybe he'll die. Or maybe Sadie will. That's the inner circle. But it's also the smallest, right? Our eyes meet, and that earlier gratitude returns. I want her here. I need a friend so badly. I can imagine with all the free time you have in here, she says. Your mind goes all sorts of places. My mind does that anyway, even when I'm not at the hospital. Mine too, she says. The thing about having kids is that there's such a small chance of something really awful happening. Like a 1% chance, maybe? But you have to keep dodging it. In the womb, you're dodging. They say up to 50% of pregnancies end in miscarriages. Then they're out in the world. We both look at Sadie. Both of our eyes fill with tears. There's a slim possibility of any one terrible thing happening to them. But you have to keep dodging. It's like this juggernaut you spend your whole life running from. But you wouldn't have it any other way, right? You can't imagine going back to your life before they arrived. No, I say. I can't imagine going back.
Chapter 24. Ellen.
So, how is she?
Brandon stands on my doorstep, his eyes worried, but something else, too. He's hungry for the update. He likes to be in the loop more than any human I've ever known. She's still in the ICU, I say. The ICU for kids. It's called the PICU. She's barely conscious, and the doctors don't know what's wrong with her.
I can't even imagine.
A baby that young in a big, scary hospital?
So full of germs? I get freaked out just visiting a place like that. I want to take a Purell shower afterward.
Well, that's why I went instead of you. His eyes narrow just slightly.
I didn't really expect you to be the one to volunteer, honestly.
I didn't expect to either, but when someone's in need, you go to them. I can tell he thinks there's more to the story, and boy is he right. But I'm not about to divulge it, especially since my plan is working. Katrina needs a confidant, and right now, it's clearly not her husband. As much as she might want to push me away, she doesn't have the strength right now.
I'd like to do something, though, he says. I can start organizing meals. Oh, and I can put together a visiting schedule, since she probably can't have a ton of people converging all at once.
There can only be 2 people at the bedside at a time. Katrina really only wants me there right now.
Really? Just you?
At my nod, he adds, Doesn't she prefer to be called Cat? Everyone loves Brandon, thinks he's so kind and good-hearted, and I used to think that too. But after what went on with my husband, we all knew the rules. They were right there on the spreadsheet in black and white. I ignore his question. Her in-laws are there too, Doug's parents. I don't think she has family of her own.
In fact, I know she doesn't. I'll work on the meals then, Brandon says, with just the slightest touch of obstinacy.
She doesn't want anything from anyone.
Does Doug want anything?
So, he's setting his sights on Doug now? I shrug. Take it up with them. Oh, wait, I just told you that you can't. I want to smile at the handcuffs I've placed on Brandon, kind of like the ones he placed on my husband.
So, they really want nothing from us?
He looks distressed.
This is what community is for. This is why you move to the AV. We band together for support. Everyone's stronger with the village behind them.
What are they thinking?
She's thinking about Sadie.
She's going to what she knows.
Which is?
Handling things on her own. He shakes his head.
So sad. But I guess people do return to what they know in times of crisis.
His tone isn't barbed, but I feel a chill anyway. I've always wondered what my husband told him. What you discover is that the scariest part of openness isn't the sex. It's the pillow talk. You can never be entirely sure what other people know. What slips out after they've slipped it in.
I should go, I say, moving to shut the door. Let me know if anything changes.
You'll be the first.
Really? He's the only one who needs to know. He's better than a megaphone.
Our entire block will be feeling the sting of Katrina's rejection within the hour.
Sorry, I say. I'm in my gown and mask, having vigorously scrubbed up to my elbows.
But I don't recognize the two senior citizens in the cordoned-off area behind the yellow and black tape. I start to withdraw, but then I see that Sadie's inhabiting the raised dais.
Oh, Sadie.
The air in here smells residually noxious, like she had another recent bout of diarrhea. She appears as lifeless as she did yesterday, and her skin still has the tinge of urine. It hurts to look at her.
Are you here for Doug and Katrina?
The man says. There's something military about him, though he's dressed casually in khakis and a polo shirt.
Yes, I'm a friend. Well, a new neighbor.
Oh, that's so lovely, the woman exclaims. I dislike her immediately. There's just something false about her. Like mother, like son.
I'm Scott, and this is Melody,
the man says. Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Melody beams.
Doug and Katrina are in the cafeteria. They'll be back soon. The waiting room is right down the hall.
Okay, thanks. It's interesting that Scott and Melody are calling Katrina by her full name. I guess they're not cat people either.
Who should I say stopped by?
Melody pesters.
I'll go find them. Thanks.
The cafeteria is spacious and purple, like Barney exploded. There's plenty of noise and bustle, but Katrina is sitting alone, picking at a croissant, her eyes glazed. Seeing her there brings me back to a place I never go. When I was in elementary school, and she was the new girl who nobody really wanted to talk to or sit with, I took her under my wing and looked after her. We were so close. But she betrayed me. It took me so many years to recover, and the AV was a big part of that. So, I can't have those kinds of memories or any twinges of conscience. I have to remember she brought this on herself. I take the seat across from her.
Hey,
I say. I'm a little nervous since I've removed my mask and the lighting is nearly fluorescent. Much starker than daylight and a hell of a lot brighter than Hound. We're looking at each other more intensely than we ever have before. I don't want her to notice the slant of my eyes or the curve of my jawline.
I met Scott and Melody. They told me where to find you.
Fortunately, she just keeps playing with a croissant.
Hi. How are you? Her temperature spiked, and she had more diarrhea. They say it's back under control now.
Tears fill her eyes.
But for how long?
They're taking good care of her. It just takes some time for the antibiotics to work.
They'll only work if it's bacterial. The nurses and doctors are supposed to be more attentive on the PICU than on the regular floors. But even so, they left the leads on her chest for 2 whole shifts. There were red marks.
The table next to us looks over briefly, then turns away, realizing that you can't judge here.
They're supposed to change those every shift. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help her. I just have to depend on these people. I just have to hope.
She puts her head in her hands, and I think she's going to start sobbing. I remind myself that no matter what, I will not feel for her. I can't. It would be so much easier if I were some kind of monster. But she fucked up my family. I have every right to fuck up hers. Besides, Sadie's going to get better. I can't miss my opportunity. I might not get another this good. Katrina cannot stay in my neighborhood. I wouldn't be able to survive. This is my moment. I have to seize it, monstrous as it might seem. She looks up, and her eyes are dry. That helps me a little.
Why are you here?
She asks, none too friendly. That helps, too. I've been through this before, I say. I've had a sick child, too.
In the hospital?
I nod. I remember being in this very cafeteria. It's a gamble, what I'm about to do. I read this book once about going undercover, and it said you should always use your real name and lie as little as possible. That way, you won't have so much to remember, and you're less likely to trip yourself up. The book also said that you should find something to like in even the vilest people. Find an area of common ground. See if they love their families like you love yours, if you're into the same sports team, even. You want to like them, at least a little, in order to make them like you.
Fat chance of that.
So, lying isn't recommended when you're undercover, but I need to build trust quickly. Besides, it doubles as kindness. She wants to know about another child who went through this and survived.
What happened?
She asks.
Same thing. Some weird virus at maybe 6 or 7 months old. 8 days in the hospital, and then a full recovery. The staff here is amazing. They know what they're doing. Some seem to care. Others just seem so rushed. That's because they have to be everywhere at once. It's because they're working so hard. And how could anyone not care about Sadie? They'd have to be total monsters. Sometimes, she whispers, I think this wasn't an accident.
What do you mean?
That someone tried to hurt her. Is that crazy?
If she's telling me this, then she doesn't think I'm the one who did it. Unless she's telling me because she thinks I'm the one who did it. She could be baiting me. I keep my face as composed and empathetic as I can. When your child is sick, you have all kinds of crazy thoughts.
Believe me, I know.
I remember. She's got her fingers back in the croissant in a manner that's oddly proctologic.
You're going to tell them, aren't you? Tell whom?
She doesn't answer.
What happens in the hospital stays in the hospital. I'm the one who wanted to be here with you.
She stares at me. I mean, a bunch of the neighbors wanted to be here. We thought I'd be the best choice because I've been through it. I see from her face that she's not quite ready to buy what I'm selling. Speaking of buying and selling, I wonder if before all this happened she was going to opt in or out. Which way she was leaning. I was the one who pushed the hardest to make her a regular so quickly. Sure, the others liked her, and sure, the spreadsheet could use some new possibilities. But I thought a proposition like that, so soon, would send her running for the hills. Instead, she was supposedly thinking about it, and then we all got invitations to a barbecue. Maybe Katrina really has changed. Or maybe I'm just really bad at this. You've got enough to worry about, I tell her. Don't stress at all about my repeating anything we say. Everything is off the record. Eyes down again.
You met Scott and Melody?
Yes.
What were your initial impressions?
It's clearly a test. If I say they seemed great, but she hates them, or if I say they seem like pieces of work and she adores them, or if I give some milquetoast answer. With abuse survivors, you might not get that many chances. You can lose credibility in an instant, and the relationship will never recover. So I've got to go with my gut. Scott seemed okay, but I'd watch out for her. Her eyes widen.
That's what I think, too. Doug says I'm totally off base.
I'm into people who are kind, not nice. You can't trust nice. And she's got nice written all over her. Katrina smiles.
You hit the nail on the head.
Then the smile dissolves.
Doug and I can't even talk about her right now. That's why he's not here. He stormed off after I said something neutral. He thought I was insulting her. I wouldn't do that. Not now.
Huh. Not now. That means something happened recently. So it wasn't just generic or stress-related tension I observed. There was an inciting event and a history underpinning it. That's rough, I say. Marriages can be minefields. Kind of like these conversations.
I get scared sometimes, since Doug and his mom are so close.
Scared of what? She hesitates, but just for a second. She's dying to tell someone.
I was so stupid. I trusted them, and now they've got all the power.
In what way?
My credit's bad, so Scott, Melody, and Doug are the only names on the deed.
I'll have to file away that little nugget, see if it could be useful. It certainly won't hurt to feed her paranoia and get her to dig her own grave with the in-laws. It also gives me a backup angle. Maybe I can get Doug to kick her out, if that's his house, not hers. Or let something slip to the in-laws. Just watch your back, I say. That's all. If she's busy watching her back, she won't even see me coming.
Chapter 25. Cat. I'm alone the next time she shows up. I'm alone a lot. Doug has made it very clear he doesn't want to be with me right now. What's unclear is why. Did he see that photo before I deleted it? Did he hear a rumor? Is this still about what I said to Sadie about Melody while I was in the shower? Or is it that he thinks another mother would have taken better care of Sadie? All of the above? I'm afraid to ask. I don't even want to know. But it means I'm left with my own terrified thoughts. I don't sleep. I can barely think. And I know I should stop telling her things, but a part of me feels like I'm already in so deep. And I can't just be in my head all the time. And for some reason I can't put my finger on. I trust her. Layton made it hard for me to trust myself, but Dr. Morrison always said I'm supposed to go with my instincts. My instincts say that this woman in front of me is a good person, who wants to be here for me. Just because she happens to live in the AV alongside a certain nasty note writer shouldn't automatically disqualify her. Sadie's still attached to all her machines, but I'm cradling her. I didn't know you were allowed to take her out, she says. Didn't you hold your baby sometimes? The rules must have changed. Wow, that would be awful, to never be able to pick her up. But even so, I don't take Sadie out much. I don't want to disturb her. She needs her sleep so she can fight the infection, whatever it is. She looks like she's sleeping right now. I don't know if it's sleep or some other loss of consciousness. I just know that I'm desperate for her to come back for good. She doesn't have the energy to be her feisty self. There's been no diarrhea today, but her iron count is even lower. It's like one thing gets better and something else gets worse. They still don't know what's wrong. And she won't drink my milk. It's still all intravenous fluids. I pump out rivers, and the nurses label the bottles and put them away for me like we might need them later. She'll never catch up with all that milk. I should just dump it, but I can't. It would be like saying she's not going to get better. Sadie's going to get better, she says. It's jarring, as if she could read my thoughts. Maybe it's that they're such obvious thoughts. Any mother would have them. In the night, she had chills along with her fever. It was so terrible. She was just lying there, vibrating, and it took a while for the medicine to work. All I could do was watch. I was afraid to touch her, afraid I'd make it worse. I pull Sadie closer to me, but gently. She'll be here a few more days, at least. I carefully put Sadie back inside the cube, realizing she hasn't stirred during this entire conversation. Would someone tell me if she were comatose? Would a mother know? Maybe not this mother. I let my hands hang, limp and useless, at my sides. I smell. I haven't changed my clothes. I've been pretending we're going home any hour now, any day. Doug's gone home to shower. Is he bringing you some clothes back? They probably have a shower you can use here at the hospital. I don't care. I don't care how I look or how I smell. I deserve to stink. Before Doug, I didn't think I had what it took to be a mother. Maybe I was right. Another mother would have gotten her help sooner. Another mother wouldn't have engendered such bad will in her new neighborhood that I wanted so much to have a community, and look what happened. I don't even know what I'm thinking anymore. I crumple into the chair. A nurse comes in at just that moment. She's young and perky, pretty but for an astonishing overbite. Hi, she says with a slight southern twang. I'm Kendall. Hi, I say listlessly. There's a sweetness to Kendall, an innocence. But I wish Sadie had someone a little more seasoned. Kendall checks Sadie's vitals. She's bad at the baby blood pressure cuff and has to redo it. Sadie wakes with an ear-splitting cry. I look up, almost happy. That's Sadie's cry, I say. The angry cry, distinctive as a fingerprint. I move behind the plexiglass cube and put my hands flat against Sadie's cheeks. I tell her it'll be okay. The cries continue, louder if that's possible, and still, this is the happiest I've been since I brought Sadie to the ER. You tell 'em, girl, I say. We listen to the symphony of Sadie's machines, in concert with the machines behind all the other curtains. My joy fades. Doug should have been back at the hospital a while ago. It doesn't take 2 hours to shower. Should I text him and tell him that Sadie did her angry cry? He hasn't answered my other messages. Could you maybe go find Doug for me? It might seem like a strange request, but it's not like she's a threat. She's not going to seduce Doug in a hospital. Where do you think he is? I don't know. The cafeteria, maybe? Somewhere with his parents? He hasn't answered my texts. I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but I can't leave Sadie alone while I try to find her wayward father. He's having trouble with this whole thing. It's hard having a baby in a hospital, no doubt. I feel like maybe he blames me, because I was the one home with her when she got sick. I'm sure he doesn't blame you. I didn't have much of a mother. Melody, Doug's mother, was apparently the perfect mom. An inscrutable expression crosses her face. No one gets the perfect mom. Melody thinks that I can't possibly be expected to know what I'm doing because of my own mother. She condescends to me all the time. What I'm really afraid of is that she's fueling Doug's negativity about me. She's always thought I'd be a disappointment as a mother, and now he does, too. But maybe Melody's right. Maybe she would have known her baby was sick much earlier than I did. Maybe I didn't take care of Sadie the way I should have. You did the best you could, Katrina. My head snaps up, and my stomach drops. No one in the AV calls me Katrina. Seeing my reaction, she explains, "That's what Melody and Scott called you, when I ran into them in the hospital room." It makes sense, but still. I go by Kat. You know that.
You're a great mom, Kat. You are. The whole block can see it.
What else can the whole block see, I wonder? Not for the first time.
Chapter 26. Ellen. The anger keeps coming back to me, little aftershocks. I try to stop thinking about what Katrina said about perfect mothers. I had a perfect mother, and Katrina killed her. Technically, it was cancer, but it wasn't even a year after our world came crashing down. I know what really caused her death. It was humiliation. I almost died of it, too. But I managed to get through, and I became a mother, and that allowed me to let go of so much of the anger. My transformation, both physical and emotional, was complete with that baby in my arms. The AV helped, too. To come from where I did, with all the losses and pain and the infamy, to a place of initial anonymity and, later, full acceptance and love, it brought me back to life. And now Katrina wants to take it away. She wants to co-opt it and make it hers. I will not let her destroy this new family of mine, the AV family, like she did the last. Speaking of home, I've been neglecting my duties because I've been so consumed with Katrina. There's barely any food in the house, so I have to stop off at Trader Joe's, where I immediately run into Val and Patrick. It's the one downside of my new life. When I want to be anonymous again, I can't really pull it off. Val asks immediately about Sadie, and she and Patrick both look shaken up when I tell them that there's been no change.
I can't imagine, Val murmurs.
Our kids were always so healthy,
Patrick says. While he seems genuinely sad, he can't keep his eyes from grazing my chest. Maybe what he's saddest about is that he never got the chance to try and seduce Katrina. Kat, I have to remember to start using that name in my head, otherwise Katrina is going to slip out again. I had to do a lot of trust building and damage control to come back from that. I can never see Val without thinking of the stripper pole she installed in their walk-in closet and the private lessons she took on how to use it. All that, and Patrick still strays. You just can't keep some people on their leash. Of course, he has permission, but everyone knows, and Patrick must realize, that Val doesn't want an open marriage. She knows it's either give permission or he'll just do it anyway behind her back. Not on the block. We'd respect their opt-out. But there's a whole world out there. For a while, the spreadsheet said Val was available for casual flings, no overnights, never in her own bed. According to Brandon, there were no takers, so she changed it to say she was off limits. Maybe that was for pride's sake, or maybe she thought that men would want what they couldn't have, and it would create some interest. As far as I know, that never happened. Even with the supposed feminism of openness, a 63-year-old man does better than a 55-year-old woman.
Patrick's been with a surprising number of the spreadsheet's women. His reputation does a lot of the heavy lifting. He'll give and give, and he gets off on that so fully that he never needs to receive. That tongue of his is legendary. It knows just where to go, it never gets tired, and the beauty of it is, since you don't have to see his face, you can just fantasize about whoever you want, for hours. The other good thing about Patrick is that he takes rejection well. He just backs away, hands in the air, to show he's harmless. No pressure, no hard feelings. Some others on the block should take notes. Revenge fucking, trophy scoring, saying I love you only to be dumped immediately, sexual obsession. Not to mention, there's never enough time for balancing juggling the spouse and the kids with an outside person. Something has to give. It's a scheduling and logistical nightmare. The spouse feels neglected, the household chores are neglected, and sexual needs go unfulfilled because one person is already fulfilled on the outside, so then the other might have to go seeking, causing the same scenarios but in reverse. And while the husband can try to satisfy his wife with his hand or mouth, his lover is often getting the dick. So there's loneliness, resentment, and loss. But somehow, no one wants to stop, because the carousel ride itself is addictive. Because everyone else is doing it. And who said peer pressure stops at a certain age? It doesn't. It goes on and on and on. Would I live anywhere else, though? No, I wouldn't. These are my best friends, and we're in it together, no matter what. The system we've crafted is complex and, at times, downright ugly. But there's love and beauty in it, too. And sex, of course. Lots of that. It beats all the alternatives. Families are messy. Maybe that was the problem with my family growing up. It was too good to be true. No, it wasn't too good. It just seemed that way to other people, so they wanted to tear it down. They envied us. Katrina most of all. That's the only explanation I've ever been able to come up with for how she could do what she did. But enough about Katrina. Cat. For one day. I need to think happy thoughts. Funny thoughts. I remember when Brandon first told me about the stripper pole and the lessons, and we couldn't stop giggling over the image of Val suspended from it, naked but for the fanny pack. While Patrick texted other women on the block madly to see who was available for some quickie cunnilingus. Brandon and I used to laugh together, and then say how bad we were being, and that we needed to stop. Poor Val. And then we'd laugh some more. Because sometimes it's just good to be bad. Ilsa didn't agree. That's why she and Niels had to go. I've texted Kat, but she hasn't responded. Val says, I don't have Doug's number. Could you just let them know we're thinking of them? As soon as they're comfortable having more visitors, we'd love to see them. You're sure we can't bring them a lasagna or something? I'm sure. They just want space. Of course, Patrick says, his eyes again stopping at my breasts. I don't even mind. It's just a quirk of his. A tick. Val sees it. And she clearly does mind. I should buy this stuff, I indicate the contents of my cart, and get back to the hospital. Later that day, when I arrive, Doug and Kat are whispering heatedly. I try to loiter outside the curtain to make out their words, but Kendall calls out a greeting to me, and when I answer, the voices cease. Hey, I say, drawing back the curtain.
Hey!
Doug is too hearty, as usual. Kat looks upset as she squeezes out a hi. Is it a bad time?
Not at all,
Doug answers as Kat says, Yes. She adds, Doug was just headed out to the waiting room. You can walk with him. She won't look at him as she tells him to send in his mom or dad or whoever. The implication is clear. She'll take anyone over him at the moment. Doug and I head out into the hall, removing our gowns on the way. I put my hand on Doug's arm, stalling his progress. He's in jeans and a t-shirt with a tiny hole at the collar, wearing way too much cologne. The bags under his eyes aren't nearly as pronounced as Kat's.
Are you okay?
I ask him. It wouldn't hurt to buddy up to him, try to get some information, or give some, depending on what's most advantageous to me. His rift with Kat could pay dividends, especially since he and his parents own the house that I want Kat to vacate. I sense his uncertainty. He's not sure how to play this. His veil is different, yet in his way, he's guarded too. He hides behind layers of joviality.
I'm holding my own, he says. I just need to support Kat. She can be kind of fragile.
Yeah, dude, you really seem to be supporting her back behind that curtain. Were you mad at each other? It was kind of intense in there. His eyes darken.
It can be intense, having a sick baby. You should know, right?
So, Kat told him my lie. But from his tone, I'm not sure he believes it.
Yes, I say. I know. It seems like you and Kat have gotten pretty close, pretty quickly.
We understand each other. He colors. He's wondering what I know that he doesn't.
Is there a reason you're the AV's representative?
I was the first to volunteer, and now Kat doesn't want anyone else just showing up. She trusts me.
And what about what I want? Who I trust?
They're assuming Kat speaks for both of you. Doesn't she?
I like people,
he nearly yells. A nurse walking by casts him a quick, reproving glance, and he gives her a reflexive smile. That's his tick.
I like people,
he says softly.
We moved to the AV to have them around, and now she's making the executive decision to only have you here.
Well, I say finally, talk to your wife about it. He turns and stalks away, leaving me to follow him. In the waiting room, I see someone he'd apparently prefer. It's Andy, in a halter dress and high-heeled sandals. Doug seems happy to see her, yet not surprised. Did he call her? Or did she call him? The block knows to go through me, but Andy's not exactly on the block. She's sitting beside Doug's parents, and they're all talking like old friends. Andy's good at forging connections with people immediately. It's crossed my mind before that it's an act, just a really good one. But Nolan assures me that Andy is 100% real. And I have to admit, the vast majority of the time I'm as captivated by Andy as everyone else. She's like the cheerleader that you just can't manage to hate, because she's rooting for you too. She has a star quality that somehow only burns brighter because she reveals just enough of her foibles, her messy car, her shyness at girls' night, the bitten nails with a $100 manicure. Scott has his finger in a paperback spy thriller, holding his place, while Andy and Melody talk with great animation. At Doug's entrance, Andy leaps to her feet and embraces him, rubbing his back in a way that seems far too intimate. But Andy is a truly friendly person and an empathetic one, so perhaps I'm misreading the situation. Andy's the one who wanted to opt out of the spreadsheet. No one questions her love for Nolan. When she sees me behind Doug, she releases him immediately. She greets me with an equally giant hug, sans the back rub, almost like she's trying to illustrate just how normal her previous one had been. But then, Andy is a touchy-feely sort of person.
You met Andy?
Doug asks his parents.
She introduced herself, Melody says approvingly.
Sadie's vitals were stable all last night and today, Doug reports. No diarrhea, no fever.
Doug grins.
The tests and cultures have all come back, and they're negative. If everything stays normal through tomorrow, this could be her last night in the PICU.
That's great news, Melody says.
Damn straight,
Scott seconds.
You must be so relieved.
Andy gives Doug one of her sweet smiles.
I'm feeling pretty good,
Doug says. Then why did it look so awful between him and Kat just a few minutes ago? You'd think Sadie's recovery would have brought them together.
If all goes well, Sadie will move to a regular hospital room for observation, and then she comes home.
My emotions are a complicated brew. I'm happy that Sadie's turned a corner. I'd love to see her acting like a normal baby again, squirming and squalling and laughing. But it means that I have a lot of work left, and not much time. At the hospital, I can just keep stopping by, but once Kat's home, I'll need to be invited in. She could freeze me out so easily. She could connect with the other women, who'll greet her like a returning hero. This is a very loving neighborhood, after all. A forgiving one, too. That's why I moved here. Unlike the other couples, I already knew about openness, and I was trying to get in. Not just to the AV, but to that very block.
Really? I was recruited.
No, that's too strong a word.
Lured.
Nope, still wrong. It's more like I was convinced, told that it would help my marriage, and I believed that it would. Through years of experience and observation, here's what I've learned. When openness works, it works because it's temporary. People can talk differently and flirt differently because they don't have to look each other in the eyes for the rest of their lives. They avoid the routine. They don't have to do the boring stuff like getting kids ready for school. They'll never depend on each other. They can fuck without giving a fuck. Sex slows down in marriage because it's hard to really share yourself with someone, tell them everything about yourself, and then still want them sexually. Openness tries to give people a way around that, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But I love that the AV lets you try.
Well, let's go celebrate,
Scott says, getting to his feet.
Should we take a trip to the cafeteria? I've barely been eating, but all of a sudden, I'm ravenous,
Doug says. He asks Andy if she wants to go with them. I'm conspicuously left out. Melody and Scott probably wish Kat was more like Andy, poised, expensively dressed, with impeccable social graces. Kat probably wishes that herself. I hate when I start feeling sorry for Katrina. Melody has wound her arm through Scott's, and they're about to head to the cafeteria. I'm hoping Andy will go with them, and then I can get some alone time with Kat. But instead, Andy turns to Doug, and then to me, asking,
Could I be the one to go in next? I haven't seen Kat or Sadie in days.
Sure.
Doug smiles at her like she's a real gem. He continues to ignore me.
I'll go in afterward,
I say quickly. Andy picks up a bulging canvas bag from one of the chairs.
I brought Kat some things.
She holds up items one at a time, brandishing them like a spokesmodel. There's pricey shampoo, conditioner, and body wash, a travel-size blow dryer, and layers of clothes. T-shirts, a lightweight cardigan, and yoga pants, all of them expensive with the tags still on. So Kat can smell and dress like Andy. The way Andy's looking at Doug and that bag for Kat, if I didn't know Andy better, if I wasn't so sure of her love for Nolan, I'd think something strange was going on. But what I know and what I'll tell Kat are two very different things.
I also brought energy drinks and snacks and some books and toys for Sadie,
Andy continues.
Looks like you thought of everything,
Doug says admiringly. He's not talking about me, but he should have been.
Chapter 27. Kat. Could I hold her? She asks. I'm surprised by my reaction, which is nearly feral. I clutch Sadie in an involuntary spasm.
A protective instinct. No, a maternal instinct. She takes it in stride. Now that she's finally better, I can understand you not